Radio. Discussing problems that we have. You know how that goes, right? Nothing serious. But anyway, a little bit tired, but walked outside and it was in the 50s. And right now it's 52 degrees, and it brightens your spirit when weather's like that. I was sad to hear that Adam said that might be some rain later this afternoon. I was going to sit out in my backyard and look at my gardens that haven't done anything yet. Well, I shouldn't say that. I do have several herbs, like my chives. And let's see. I have a few other herbs that are kind of showing a little tiny bit of life. But I know I'll have more of those. Hey, today we're going to be joined by Fred, and he'll be coming on as soon as he's able to. He's running, and he has to do an errand, I guess you'd call it, this morning. And then he's going to call in because he's not going to be here. And we will discuss stuff. He's found a great book about the White House and all the odd things that have happened in the White House. So join us a little later. And prior to that, I thought, what the heck? Today, happy St. Paddy's Day, and also happy start of March Madness Day. And as you probably know, I was in intercollegiate athletics for about 18 years, and my very first NCAA tournament, I was with DePaul University, and I thought what I'd do is go over some of the stuff that happens at these events, just give you a taste of what's going to happen to all the players, coaches, and staff that surrounds them. When I was at DePaul, we had a brand new kid, a rookie, a freshman, and his name was Mark Aguirre, not Maguire, Mark Aguirre, who eventually became the number one draft choice in, 81, I think? Maybe it was 82. I don't really recall which one of those years it was. He left before he graduated. He left as a junior. But anyway, so we were pretty good, and I had been, had done nothing in intercollegiate athletics to that point. I walked into DePaul University probably in, I think it was September of 78. Boy, we're really going back, aren't we? And I walked in, and my athletic director was Father Gilo. Father Gilo was a brilliant guy. He truly was. He had a twin brother, and he was also a priest, by the way. But Father Gilo all he wanted to do is make sure that I was comfortable in the job. I lived about 55 miles away, so I had to take a train in, then I had to take the L, then I had to walk a little bit. So some mornings my commute would take 2 hours and a quarter. Most mornings it was right around 2 hours. And if I drove in instead of taking the train in, I could make it in about an hour and 15 minutes. It wasn't too bad if the traffic was okay. But anyway, I was really excited to go to work there. And I was excited because we had this great new athlete, Mark Aguirre, and we had a pretty good cast of others. Skip Dillard, boy, I'm struggling to remember everybody at this. I'm struggling to remember my favorite of the bunch, who scared me one night. Just snuck up behind me and scared me while I was walking in downtown. Curtis Watkins, while I was walking in downtown Chicago. Anyway, we had some great kids, and we had a kid named what do we call him? Shoot. It doesn't make any difference, does it? It was too long ago. Anyway, we opened up at Provo, Utah. That's where we started. I can't remember what bracket we were in, but we played USC, University of Southern California. It was our very first outing, and we won that. And then we moved on to the next one, and we won that. And they were all out in near Salt Lake, either Provo or Salt Lake City or surrounding areas. But we stayed in Utah for the entire bracket, just luck of the draw, I guess. But so we ended up pretty much making home in Utah, especially the supporting staff and the coaches who, the kids had to come back and make sure they were staying up with their grades and stuff. But most of us stayed out in Utah, assuming that the next game was going to be our last game, and it never was. And we went all the way to the Final Four. And our opponent, the first opponent that we had in the Final Four, was the team that came in second. You may remember their number one player. Everybody called him Bird. And we were, the night before we had to play Larry in Indiana State, Curtis Watkins, who, like I told you earlier, was my favorite player on that team. Curtis had wrenched his knee in practice. And the team physician would not allow us to shoot him up so that he didn't have any pain. Rightfully so, he wouldn't do that. But Curtis thought he could play, and did play, and didn't play up to his very best, but his guarding assignment was Larry Bird. And Larry was probably about 3 inches taller than Curtis, but Curtis could jump through the ceiling. And Curtis did the best he could with a wrenched knee all taped up and everything. But pretty much Bird had his way. But we did well enough that we only lost by 2 points. It was 76-74. Taking us out of the running for the national championship. And back then they had a consolation game, and I'll tell you about that. But it was 76-74. Had Curtis been 100%, I believe we would have beaten Larry because we only lost by two, and Curtis's assignment was Larry Bird. And on that team, there was Larry Bird, and I can't remember. There was one other young man who went on to the pros, and I can't remember his name, but he was very good. But the rest of the team were really supporting characters. That's about all they were. If Larry hadn't been there, they wouldn't have gotten out of Terre Haute. But Anyway, so we were all kind of sad because we had lost, but we were very happy with how well we had done. And then Michigan State was the other team with a person you might remember, Magic Johnson. And Magic was on top of the world at the time. And Pennsylvania, the one in the Ivy League, had gotten that far, and they lost pretty soundly, I believe. I don't remember the score, but pretty soundly to Michigan State. So we ended up having to play Pennsylvania in the consolation match. And, I mean, we pounded them. For the first half, it looked like they shouldn't have been in the arena. But then they came back. We kind of let up. And they made it a very good game toward the end. But we ended up winning. And if I recall correctly, it may even still be the highest television rating for a consolation game ever in the Big Ten. Now, they don't do them anymore, I don't believe. So, therefore, it won't be broken if it's still holding. But we had a good time. We won that. We went home. We were met at O'Hare Field with a huge crowd of people applauding and wanting to pat the guys on their back and stuff like that. It was a nice month. Now, there were a few things that kind of happened that were kind of interesting. When you get your... Back then, you weren't allowed to accept gifts of over $250. You were allowed to accept one gift of $200, $250 for being in a tournament. I mean, it had to be sanctioned by the NCAA and everything. But there were all sorts of people that were trying to get, you know, in the goodwill of certain players, and Mark Aguirre was no stranger to that. People would bring by and leave at the front doors of everybody, including yours truly. I remember we got a sweatsuit, a red sweatsuit, a beautiful thing. But every player got one. Every coach and every administrator got one left at their front door at their motel room. That was absolutely a violation. So we had to turn everything in. The kids at least had to turn everything in. I still have that sweatshirt, sweat outfit. But kids had to turn all that stuff in. There were all sorts of people wanting to get a piece of, especially Mark, but any member of the team. You know, the media was all over us both before the games and after the games, quite frankly. But it was fun. But it was my first year in the business. I had no idea what I was doing. I must have done okay because we got pretty good coverage. Now, the Final Four was broadcast, I don't remember which network, but Dick Enberg, Billy Packer, and Al McGuire were the three announcers. And I got to be pretty good friends with those three guys in that month out there in Utah. Which was really nice because it held me in good stead throughout the rest of my 18 years in that business, because I've met with each one of those guys more times. Now, I know Al's passed away. I think Dick Enberg's still good, and I think Billy is still around. I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up. But I've been able to touch bases with them several times since then, for interest and for things that the teams needed and stuff like that. And, as a direct, I was what they call a sports information director. I was assistant athletic director for sports information. And what I was supposed to do was make sure that our teams were publicized and make sure that people knew about our teams. One of my jobs was to make sure we got on television the following year in Chicago. And we did. Got quite lucky and did a contract with WGN. And the rest is, everybody knows about DePaul has been on WGN for years. I think they're off of it now, but it was quite a good contract. And anyway, those are some of the things I did during the Final Four, and I have not picked my... I don't even look at the brackets anymore, but I see that we have our phone call. I did want to, by the way, mention, hey, Ron, thanks for calling in and let us know your grandson is doing okay. That was on my show that you called and asked for prayers, and I believe... I hope that the prayers helped, because it sounds like they did. Let's go to the phones and see if Fred Malone is there. Hey, Fred.
Top of the morning to you, my friend.
Good morning, top of the morning to you.
Asmaliam St. Patrick's Da.
Oh, that's easy for you to say.
That is, I like St. Patrick's Day.
Okay. I'm not going to remember that, by the way.
Well, it's a bit of the old Irish.
Yeah, I guess it is. How you feeling? You doing okay?
Well, cranked on, pretty much.
Yeah.
I was at physical therapy this morning. Of course, yeah. You know that, but yeah. For the listeners. And so I had a pretty good cranking session this morning.
Yikes. So you're a little tired, a little worn out.
Well, not too awfully bad. Again, I think the fact that going into this whole knee surgery, I've been pretty active over the last several years, so I think that helped tremendously.
Sure and, did, yeah. And you're very thin.
Well, so yeah, that kind of helps, too.
Yeah, in my case, if I had knee surgery, the weight would crush whatever they put in there.
No. Well, but anyway, yep. I'm glad to be with you today,
yeah.
And again, it's a great day for the Irish. A lot of things going on, especially in the Columbus and Dublin area today, parades and get-togethers and a lot of good food, and of course all the Irish pubs, I'm sure, are doing a wonderful business this morning. So
I was amazed. I did a little bit of Irish trivia last week, a little St. Patrick's Day trivia, and I was amazed to find out that the first St. Paddy's Day parade was not in Ireland. It was in New York City.
Right, yeah. Yep, yeah. Well, of course, if you take a look at the population of New York, I'm sure you're going to find about 50% of it is Irish.
Yeah, and there are more people in New York than probably in Ireland.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what the population of Irish of Ireland is today, but what is it? The population in New York is, what, 10 or 11 million people,
yeah,
something like that.
Something like that.
That's the size of most countries, you know, these days. So.
It is. Well, now, do you think a lot of people will be putting Notre Dame on their bracket today?
Good possibility.
I think so.
Good possibility.
Yeah.
I did see that Wright State won their game last night, which anytime I always like to see Ohio college teams get in as far as they can into the bracket.
Yeah.
Most of them, of course, don't last long. That was a play-in game for them, but it was nice to see that we've already got one Ohio team that's in. So.
What are there, 68 teams that get in?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I was in that business, there were 64.
It's always fun watching it. I'm not a huge basketball fan, but I do enjoy watching some games during the NCAA tournament, the March Madness, because it really can be madness.
Yeah,
you know,
it can.
As far as that part's concerned. And I don't know whether it was Yogi Berra or who said it, but on any given day, anybody can beat anybody else.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so you just never know. Well, I thought I'd start out. We're going to talk about best little stories from the White House today.
Yeah.
We won't cover hardly half of what's available, so we'll probably have to carry this on into next month.
Oh, that's fine. These
but
are all
hopefully
fun.
People will find some of these things interesting.
Yeah.
My information is based on a book called Best Little Stories from the White House by a guy by the name of Brian Kelly, written about, I think, about 19 years ago. I think it came out in early 2000. But I just happened to stumble across this book. I think it was actually down at the Marion's Library book sale that they have down there, which people should support because it supports the local library. But you can usually buy hardback books for a couple of bucks and paperback books for a dollar. So it's a nice way to, especially if you're a reader of novels, they always have a ton of novels down there. But stumbled across this book several months ago and have enjoyed reading it and thought I'd share some of the information with our listeners. I did want to mention before we get started, and I did call in yesterday on you and Scott's show to talk about Night at Heritage Hall coming up on the 26th. I just want to briefly mention it. This is the Marion County Historical Society's answer to Night at the Museum, a very popular series of movies that came out probably, 10 or 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah,
now.
Easily, yeah.
And what we do is we darken the museum. We give you a flashlight when you come in, and you have 3 hours to wander around the museum, look at the exhibits, and meet somewhere around 50 characters from Marion's history, Ohio history, and even some national history.
I hope you have your liability insurance paid up, because wandering around in a museum with just a flashlight sounds scary.
Well, when we say it's darkened, it's not completely dark.
Oh, okay.
So there's some lights on so you can at least see where you're going. Plus, we give you a flashlight.
Yeah, okay.
But this year, we're not doing advanced ticket sales, so all tickets can be purchased at the door. The event is the 26th, which is a week from this coming Saturday, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., so you've got 3 hours to roam around. You don't have to get here right at 6 o'clock. It takes about an hour, hour and 10, 15 minutes to go through the entire exhibit.
It's not guided, is it?
What's that?
It's not guided, is it?
No, it's not guided. It's a self-guided tour, but there are approximately 50 characters located throughout the museum that will talk to you about who they are and what they did as far as Marion's history or Ohio history, U.S. history. So it just depends on how much time you want to spend there individually. You can spend up to the entire 3 hours if you like, and some people actually do, because they'll get engaged with a certain character or characters and like to find out more information. So tickets are $5 for members of the Historical Society, $8 for non-members. Again, you buy those at the door. The door will open at 5:45 for sales. And again, we'll start the tours or start the guided self-guided tours at 6 o'clock. Some of the characters, I won't mention them all, but Dr. Charles Sawyer, who was President Harding and Mrs. Harding's personal physician, who also went to Washington with him when he was elected president, became really the first Surgeon General of the United States. Edward Huber, a very popular name in Marion, of course, the founder of the Huber Corporations. Mover and shaker of early Marion. He served on a lot of different boards in town and was on some bank boards and so forth. Jacob Hauser, another Marion name that you know. Marilyn Meskey, who was Miss America back in, I think, 1938, who was Miss Ohio two times before she became Miss America. Mary Ellen Withrow will be joining us for the evening. So that's the 40th Treasurer of the United States and a very often guest on WWGH.
Now you're going to have her live. She's not being depicted by somebody.
No, she's actually there herself. She's portraying herself. So that's good for people that have never, met her before.
Oh, you've got to meet that lady.
She's a fabulous lady. Yeah, she's a very big part of Marion's history and, of course, history of the United States as well. We've got a guy that's going to be there telling you all about different furs and having furs that you can see and pet and know what animals were prevalent here in Marion County throughout the years. Eleanor Roosevelt, wife of Franklin D. Roosevelt, scheduled to make an appearance. Frances Cleveland, who was the wife of Grover Cleveland and the only president and first lady to be married in the White House. So that should be pretty interesting. So anyway, Saturday, March the 26th, 6 to 9, at the Marion County Historical Society, which is the old post office building, located downtown in the corner of State and Church. Plenty of parking behind the museum, also parking across the street in what used to be the old Huntington Branch. And on across the street from State Street, there's plenty of parking there behind the Baptist Church. So lots of parking
available. Sounds like a great night.
All right. So that's kind of a little commercial for that.
Okay.
And I thought we'd start off this morning talking a little bit about how it all began. How did the White House begin? Where did it come from? Because as most people know, George Washington, of course, never lived in the White House because he was sworn in New York City, which was the capital of the United States, the first capital of the United States. So he spent his entire 8 years living in Washington. And then John Adams, the capital moved to Philadelphia, and then so John Adams spent the biggest portion of his one term following George Washington living in Philadelphia, and the White House actually didn't get started building until toward the end of his term. So it was actually, and this is very appropriate for today, Glenn, it was actually an Irishman from County Kilkenny who was the house carpenter, and actually the individual that designed and built the White House.
Really?
In fact, he actually built it twice because, as you know, the British set fire to the White House during the War of 1812.
Yeah.
So he was there a resident for all of 7 years during that whole time. Apparently, and this I didn't know until I started reading this book, Thomas Jefferson had actually submitted a design for the president's mansion under false initials. There was actually a competition to choose who was going to give him the honor of being the architect for the new president's mansion, and he submitted this design under these false initials, but he didn't get chosen. One way or the other, this Irishman by the name of James Hoban was the individual that emerged and became the designer of the first presidential mansion. Actually, at that time, it was called the President's House. It wasn't called the White House until a number of years later. But
yeah.
He did work under the close supervision of George Washington and Jefferson, who occasionally dropped by. Washington, even though he was done with his term of office, was very much involved with the creation of the entire federal city, which eventually, you know, bared his name. He was very scrutinizing of the plans and the site. He watched over the construction of the president's house after his term of office, and was the first public building that actually was built in Washington.
Hey, Fred,
yep.
Can you tell me why they have, it's Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. Why was it? What does District of Columbia have in it?
Well, because there was no state. They didn't want the capital to be any particular state. It started out to being in New York, and then it moved to Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They did not want it to be a particular state because they didn't want a particular state to claim the honors of being the capital of the United States.
Yeah, good idea.
So they created what they called the District of Columbia, and of course, Columbia coming from Hail Columbia, from their British roots. So it actually ended up becoming a separate entity all of itself, and of course to this day it's still not a state, but
right. The
District of Columbia.
And they can't even vote.
No, they do not have representation in Congress, although they do have...
Yeah, they can vote, but they...
Well, they do have two representatives that serve in Congress, but they are merely there as representatives of the District of Columbia, and they're not voting members of Congress.
Right.
So of the 435 members of Congress, those two members do not belong. Same way with
Puerto Rico?
The Philippines and that type of thing.
Oh.
They have a representative, but they're not a voting representative.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, so. But we talk about
slavery
a lot, and I know Scott's always talking about John Adams and him being the only president of the first several that did not own slaves. Interestingly enough, hired slaves began excavating the site in 1791.
Hired slaves?
Hired slaves.
Now, how do you hire a slave? Yeah. If he's a slave, he's a slave.
So they were slaves, but they were also being paid.
Oh, okay. They were being paid. Now, I bet that money went right to the slave owner.
Probably went right to the slave owner.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Don't know that for sure.
Yeah.
Stone cutters from Scotland later cut and finished many of the sandstone blocks that made up the outer walls of the future White House. The stone itself was native to the area. It did come from a quarry at Akia Creek, which is across the Potomac River in Virginia. And also, hired slaves worked over there, too, cutting that stone. There are several ironies about this whole thing, and it's kind of bittersweet. African Americans in the White House, the first slaves were hired out by their masters, and then the money went back through their masters' pockets and then eventually helped to fund the building of the White House. So it was kind of a pass-through thing that they established that whole line.
There probably wasn't any corruption involved.
Oh, I'm surely, you know, evidently not. How could you say that? But, of course, a number of black workers who were not slaves did work on the White House, and then a lot of those that worked on the White House eventually became servants in the White House, and they were of course paid servants. In the years following the Civil War, there was a one-time slave owner who would actually reside there with his daughter and a presidential son-in-law. As late as 1901, Teddy Roosevelt would take the heat for inviting the distinguished Booker T. Washington to dinner at the White House. Now, he was actually the first black man that was invited to sit down with a president for a lunch or a dinner.
Wow, Booker T. Washington.
Booker T. Washington,
oh,
right.
Oh, my goodness. Yep. And Teddy Roosevelt?
Teddy Roosevelt, right.
Now, I wouldn't have thought, Teddy must have been 20s or something like that. Teddy must have been very young at the time.
Well, he had just recently assumed the presidency because McKinley was assassinated in September of 1901.
Yeah.
And this took place, I think, in November or December
so
of 1901.
It was right at
so
the
Teddy
beginning.
Had just been sworn in.
Yeah.
And yes, he would have been in his very early 30s.
Yeah.
Because he was, he was McKinley's second vice president. McKinley's first vice president, Hobart, died in office. So for the last couple of years of McKinley's term, he had no vice president. And then, of course, Teddy Roosevelt was chosen to be his vice presidential running mate in the election of 1900. And that came from a guy from Ohio who had been a backer of McKinley and had suggested that Roosevelt be chosen as a vice presidential candidate because he was becoming too popular, and this way they could pigeonhole him in the vice president's office and he would never be heard of again.
Wrong.
Yeah. McKinley's assassinated shortly into his second term, and guess who takes over?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was Mark Hanna, who was from up around the Bowling Green area, that suggested that, and that didn't work out the way Hanna thought it was going to.
No.
So.
Yeah.
Very interesting from that point.
Yes.
Well, anyway, so the first president then to actually live in the presidential mansion or the president's residence was John Adams. And I think we talked about this the last time I was there. Adams only spent a very few months in the president's mansion because they actually moved in when there was nothing else around the White House. It was still basically out in the middle of nowhere. They were still laying out the city, which, of course, some people today still complain about the way that city's laid out.
Have you ever driven around D.C.?
Oh, yes, it's horrible.
It's hard to get around.
It is. It's absolutely horrible.
I used to have to take a trip in every month when I was with the Army Field Band because I was the representative to the to the Pentagon. I went to the Pentagon and gave a report to the commanding general of the USIMFO is what the name
okay,
of it.
Sure.
And we had to drive down there. And not only did I have a hard time getting my car to the Pentagon, but I had to salute all the way across the Pentagon parking lot. So, interesting time.
It is. Well, and I don't really think that, of course, Washington himself could not have envisioned and Pierre L'Enfant could not have envisioned the growth of that city. Of course, you know, designing it in the 1790s and laying it out for all practical purposes and what they thought it would be as a nation's capital with only, 13 original colonies, they had no idea what they were looking at 200 years in the future. So, but to anyone that's ever driven in the city or even been to the city and rode in a taxi or a bus can fully understand that. So, of course, by the time Adams moved into the unfinished president's house, they still did not have any indoor plumbing, obviously. They were still using outdoor toilets. It was basically a huge cavern inside. There were some rooms that had been laid out. The East Room, of course, was laid out, and that was where Mrs. Adams ran clotheslines throughout to dry their laundry. The building was only being heated by, at that time, two fireplaces, so it was very cold and very drafty most of the time that they were there. Jefferson, by the time he was able to move in, it was still not completed, so most of the work to complete the interior of the White House was done during his two terms in office.
Hey, Fred, I just looked up what the population of D.C. is. They're the 20th largest city in America, and it's 689,545.
Wow, well, that's not too big when you consider that Columbus is now over a million.
I thought that was interesting.
Well, and it's a small confines. I'd be interesting to know if your Google tells you what the
metro area
size
is.
Actual area is.
It's millions, I'm sure.
But I think today what we're going to talk about, I've just got some general categories that I want to kind of touch on.
Okay.
And then next time I come on, we'll start talking about the individual presidents and some of the things that took place there.
Okay.
But, you know, people today are so interested in their pets. And over the years, there have been a lot of pets that have lived in the White House.
The one I remember is Fowl.
If you find that information, go ahead and tell me what it is.
What's that?
The size of the city.
Oh, okay. No, I wasn't even looking. I'm sorry. Okay. But Fala is my favorite pet that ever lived there.
Fala? Yeah. I think he's probably
he's one of the
more well-knowns of all the...
Little Black Scotty.
All the critters that lived in the White House. But there have been so many different ones. And this is in no chronological order. This is just the way the author had written it out. So my notes and my information is coming from that. I think I might have mentioned once before this story, but dinner time at the White House and a visiting Will Rogers at the table as a guest of the Coolidges, Calvin and Grace, didn't really pan out the way maybe Coolidge might have thought.
Okay.
Occupying the floor during dinner were the Coolidge dogs, hungry dogs at that. and this is a quote from Will Rogers. He said, well, talking about these dogs, that they was feeding the dogs so much that at one time it looked to me like the dogs was getting more than I was. The butler was so slow in bringing one course that I came pretty near to getting down on all fours and barking to see if my business wouldn't pick up for me. Of course, Will Rogers may have stretched a point or two, but it is a fact that White House pets have wielded a very peculiar power of their own for more than 200 years.
Yeah.
For the public, they have also been a source of great fascination. Of course, most of us only... you know, are familiar with the ones of more recent times. So some of these, I think, are going to be kind of interesting to folks. Now, creatures of some influence, for instance, Warren Harding, Coolidge's immediate predecessor, and Lyndon Johnson, four decades later, were also known to take their dogs into cabinet meetings.
Huh.
Now, if you remember, Johnson had beagles.
Yes.
And you remember he got into trouble for picking up one of the beagles by the
ears. Yeah.
Saying that this was the way that they handled the dogs. Benjamin Harrison was led on a merry chase down the streets of Washington by his Whiskers, the pet goat that he had given to his grandchildren. This particular goat had been sent to the White House by the White House coachman, and he was now the White House pet. In this particular instance, the goat got away from the kids, and he was pulling the goat cart down Pennsylvania Avenue with the kids behind chasing down the goat. Harrison happened to be looking out at the time and saw it. So here's the President of the United States, Benjamin Harrison, in his long frock coat and top hat and cane, running down the street chasing after this goat and the cart with the kids behind.
Oh, jeez. What a
picture. Can you imagine that today?
Oh, the media would have gone nuts.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
I did find out it was 6 1/3 million people living in the metro area.
6 1/3 million people, but that's not Washington proper.
No.
Yeah. But that takes in Georgetown and all the surrounding area, probably.
It does.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, I'm sorry.
So anyway, I would have loved to have seen that sight. You know, Benjamin Harrison, we have one of our presidential reenactors portrays Benjamin Harrison as just, you know, a very staid individual.
Right.
I could just see him running down the street, cane and top hat in hand, chasing a go-kart. Abe Lincoln had two goats, Nanny and Nanco, and they had the run of the house. Nanny was once found snoozing on son Tad's bed. And on another occasion, Abe piled Tad and both goats into a carriage for a ride out into the Washington Soldiers Home, where Lincoln often visited the soldiers that were ill, you know, from the Civil War.
Yeah, jeez.
Another Lincoln animal, incidentally, was a turkey named Jack. Now, Jack had once been marked for the dinner table, but Tad was very upset by the fact that Jack was going to meet the hatchet. So he talked his dad out of not cutting the head of the turkey off, and he turned him into a pet.
So the very first turkey being pardoned was not, who was it, Kennedy or somebody?
Yeah, within later years.
Yeah.
It actually started with Lincoln because of the son, son Tad, not wanting
what
to see the
nice
turkey killed.
What a nice boy Tad was. Yeah.
Of course, house privileges were not restricted to goats. We've talked a lot about goats.
Yep.
Nor to dogs, cats, and even pet birds. Teddy Roosevelt's kids had a pony named Algonquin.
Huh.
Now, have you ever heard this story?
No, I have not.
One of T.R.'s sons, Quentin, had been sick with whatever, and had been spending all of his time up in the presidential residence on the second floor. So this one particular time when Clinton was getting kind of antsy and tired of laying in bed, the other kids took Snuck Algonquin, the pony, into the house, put him on the elevator, and rode the pony upstairs to the second floor where Clinton rode him briefly up and down the presidential quarters. Now, this is TR. This is true TR. Additional pets that enlivened the White House during the tenure of Roosevelt included, of course, he had six kids living there,
yep.
Included guinea pigs, two kangaroo rats, a badger, a one-legged rooster, a pig, a hyena, a small bear, an owl, a lizard, a rabbit named Peter, a flying squirrel, a rat that T.R. himself once depicted as crawling all over everybody, and described as having a most friendly and affectionate nature.
So Peter the Rabbit was actually in the White House.
Peter the Rabbit lived in the White House.
What a great Easter that would have been.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Fowl was Frank FDR's dog.
Correct,
I forgot to tell people
right.
that. Okay, go ahead.
And was with him at all times during World War II.
Yeah.
Then, too, there were in the T.R. Roosevelt house, there was a macaw by the name of Eli Yale. Of course, Roosevelt attended
to him. Like the bird?
A bird, right.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. And Alice, his daughter Alice, had a pet garter snake that she had named Emily Spinach. So, of course, you know, can you just picture the White House with six kids and about 30 pets?
A menagerie, yes.
Roaming all over yeah. the place. And, of course, you know, Roosevelt once made the comment when asked by a reporter how he was managing his daughter Alice. Alice was quite the gadabout. She was involved in a little bit of everything. And to this question, Roosevelt explained, "Well, I can take care of Alice, or I can be president of the United States, but I cannot do both." Alice required way too much time.
Yeah, she must have had a nanny or something then, huh?
Well, his wife at the time, she pretty much run shot over the kids, but didn't do a very good job of it.
Okay.
One of the things that Alice used to do was sit on the roof of the White House with a .22 rifle and shoot at things
on
the White House grounds.
Holy cow.
She was quite the girl.
Yeah.
Speaking of snakes, a young Clinton one time burst into his father's office with four handsome, wiggly snakes that he just purchased at a pet store. Never mind that TR was a bit occupied with some VIP visitors, Quentin simply dumped out the steaks on the table.
Oh, jeez. I would have been gone.
And as author Kelly reported in his book, Presidential Pets, all hell broke loose.
Yeah, I bet it would be.
Everybody shrunk back, but the snakes paid little attention. They were busy fighting each other.
Oh.
In time, Quentin and TR managed to gather them all up, and Quentin was made to take them back to the pet shop.
Oh, jeez. Well, if you've ever had kids, you know kids like to bring all sorts of critters in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, the oldest child was Alice. She was the firstborn of his first wife. His first wife died in childbirth, or shortly thereafter, when she was bearing Alice. She was the owner of a black Pekingese named Manchu, and that was a gift from the Empress of China. Now, Manchu lived with Alice for several years, and she once claimed to have seen it dancing on its hind legs in the moonlight on the White House lawn.
Oh, sure. And we all believe that.
Oh, sure, absolutely. How much time we have?
Well, we're down to a minute. So
1 minute,
yeah.
Okay. Other White House pets over the years made their presence known in various ways. Ulysses Grant had gamecocks. They fought so much that they had to be eliminated because they were awaking the neighbors by screaming at night and crowing, and especially in the early dawn hours. That would be very upsetting to people in the area.
Yeah,
of course, back in those days, other people lived near the White House. So.
Yeah, that did sound like a good dinner.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Absolutely.
Hey,
we'll stop there
okay.
and continue after the break.
Yeah, we these These are great stuff. I'm glad you found that book. What's the name of that book again?
It is called Best Little Stories from the White House.
Okay. Well, we'll do more with Fred and Best Little Stories from the White House right after we take this 15-minute break. And actually, I think it's shorter than that today.
Okay.
And Fred will hang in there with us, and we'll be back in 15 minutes. I have to vamp for 15 seconds now, so bear with me here.
Sure.
And I hope everybody's having a wonderful St. Paddy's Day. It's a beautiful day outside. Get out there and look around, and I think you'll be surprised at how beautiful it is out there.
You're listening to WWE Radio 107.1 FM, your place for politics. For Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump,
we welcome to these microphones Donald Trump. Donald, how are you?
God, how are you? Doing
very well. What a busy week for you, sir.
I have to tell you, I have not slept in days. I'm very, very excited. This is going to be a phenomenal, phenomenal convention. Probably the biggest star-studded convention you've ever seen. We've got huge stars. We've got Gary Busey, LaToya Jackson, Jose Canseco, some of the really, really big names from Celebrity Apprentice, and I think it really, really is.
Now what do we have in store for your big acceptance speech Thursday night?
Well, before I get to that, I have to talk about your terrible, terrible, terrible Governor John Kasich.
Oh, no.
I think what he's doing is terrible. Did I mention it's terrible? Because I think it's terrible. He's not endorsing me, which I think is crazy. He's really not helping at all. He's not showing up. I don't know what this guy's problem is. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he's got like a supercut haircut. He has a terrible suit on. I could really, really help this guy out, but I have to tell you something. I am not going to help him because he's not helping me. And I'm a very nice guy, but he is not being nice to me.
Well, Donald, that was on my list of things to ask you about because he...
Well, I had to get right to it because I just cannot get over that he's doing this. It makes no sense.
Well, he said, and this is his quote, he said, I'm going to get Kasich's quote right here. He says, "Why would I feel compelled to support someone whose positions I kind of fundamentally disagree with?"
Mm-hmm. Yes, but doesn't he know we're in the same party? I mean, Mike Pence and I don't agree on anything, nothing. And he's my VP. And then I was thinking about Chris Christie, who I've mentioned many, many times before. I like Chris. He gets my dry cleaning. He gets, you know, fast food. He just runs all these amazing errands. You know, he'll shut down an entire bridge just to get us some Chinese food. It's really, really incredible. I have to say that. But, you know, I like Chris. You know, and he's like most Americans. He's like most Americans. Type A personality, type 2 diabetes. But the issue that I saw with Chris was, and, you know, we've already had problems with the Trump-Pence logo. I think you know about this. But I was afraid with Chris they were going to make jokes. And I don't like to be made fun of. And they were going to say Trump and plump. And I didn't want that for Chris. You know what I mean?
What about 100,000 protesters in Cleveland this week? Does that give you pause?
I think that's fantastic. I mean, nobody has more protesters than me. And wait till the riots. You're going to see fantastic riots in Cleveland. These are going to be the best riots you've ever seen. I inspire amazing riots. And these are going to be top-notch riots.
Well, I tell you what, Donald, I know it's such a busy time for you. I can't thank you enough. I know you dislike the media, but I always thank you for stopping by.
Well, you know, Scott, you've always been very, very nice to me. You don't hit me with any of those hardball questions, which I think is great. I really appreciate that.
WWGH Radio, your place for politics. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Catch us on any mobile device by downloading the free TuneIn app and searching WWGH. Programming on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number 740-225-4495. Webpage crtmechanicals.com. The Marion Towers Apartments are a supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Address 400 Delaware Avenue. Phone number 740-387-9050.
OhioNotary.us is a proud supporter of WWGH Radio. Telephone number 740-531-2326. Website ohionotary.us. Providing notarization services of any document, anywhere in Mid and Central Ohio, at homes and businesses. ohionotary.us, a proud supporter of WWGH Radio.
We here at WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are proud to present Magnificent Marion Moments. One of Marion's most famous residents was Warren G. Harding, the 29th President of the United States of America and a former United States Senator from Ohio. Harding won election as president in 1920.
This is Weasel Boy, and my favorite letters are WWGH.
This is Scott Spears looking down on the beautiful city of Marion from the WWGH News Chopper. If you would like to ever submit a news tip or an event to the WWGH News Department, email Scott at WWGH1071.com and watch out for the chopper. And now a few words from Scott Spears, Charlie Evers, and the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams.
I've got my milk and my bowl and my saucer.
Sounds like you're getting ready for breakfast. What are you having?
Well, I'm having a bowl of golden grams with a side of toast with golden butter and a nice golden glass of apple juice.
I should have known.
Ah.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, the talking place.
This is Lulu Roman from the hit TV series Hee Haw, and I want you to listen to the Adam the Computer Guy show Tuesday and Thursday, 2:10 to 3 p.m., right here on WWGH Radio, 107.1 FM in Marion, Ohio. Streaming live on the internet at WWGH1071.com. You can also download the free TuneIn app on any mobile device and search WWGH to listen anywhere in the world.
Hello, neighbors. This is pastor and Bible teacher Craig Heilman inviting you to join me this Sunday and every Sunday from 11:10 a.m. to 12 noon for Study His Word Radio. And that's exactly what we do. We'll take a few moments, open up God's Word, and study it. We'll also spend some time talking about current events that relate to the church. We'll have some interviews with local people of faith. We'll answer your Bible questions, and we'll take your comments about our study. So please, join me this Sunday, every Sunday, at 11:10 a.m., right here on WWGH 107.1.
It's now time for WWGH News. News about people, places, and plans. Brought to you live from the WWGH Newsroom.
This is Adam Lepp in the WWGH Newsroom. Marion City Council held its regular meeting on Monday the 14th. A contract between the city and the union that represents employees of the Public Works Department contained a clause that would provide a lump sum payment of $1,000 for each union employee who is fully vaccinated and up to date with the COVID-19 vaccine. That union represents employees who work in the city's streets, sanitation, transit, and wastewater treatment departments. That clause was the main reason why an ordinance to ratify and approve a new contract was not passed. The Marion Police Department will soon start accepting applications for the position of police officer. For more information, please visit marionohiopolice.com/join. The Mansfield Post of the Ohio State Highway Patrol responded to a single vehicle crash on U.S. 30 at U.S. 42 at 4:11 a.m. on March 17th. Troopers located the vehicle on its top in the northbound lanes of U.S. 42 with a single occupant trapped inside. The driver has been identified as Antonio Juan LaShawn L. Cleveland, age 28, of Cauga Falls. The preliminary investigation shows the driver was traveling east on U.S. 30, approaching the overpass for U.S. 42. The driver drove off the left side of the road, vaulted onto the southbound lanes of U.S. 42, struck the concrete lane divider, and overturned into the northbound lanes of U.S. 42, where it came to final rest. The driver was pronounced deceased at the scene. The Richland County Sheriff's Department, Madison Township Fire EMS, and Richland County Coroner's Office assisted on scene. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine has signed Senate Bill 215, which allows Ohioans to carry a concealed firearm without a permit, as long as they are qualified to own a firearm. After signing the legislation, the governor said, "I'm not going to say much today other than the job of the governor is to make tough decisions, and I have decisions to make. That's about all I will say." The governor's press secretary